session number 11308, route 3.
Well, Wing Commander, when we were last talking, we were talking about when you left Number 32 Squadron and came home, and I think your mechanics wrote to you, telling you how the squadron had got on.
This was a very interesting letter. It's nice, of course, to hear other people talking about you and see what their reactions were. These boys had been looking after my aircraft during the period that I was with the squadron. The fitter was dealing with the engine side of things, and the rigger, Corporal Dalton, was looking after the rigging and so on. They were both splendid fellows. This letter was interesting. I just quote perhaps one paragraph. Hold. He called Davidson. He wishes me, to quote the paragraph, he wishes me to thank you for him, quote the last paragraph of that letter.
Yes, it says, so much for the officers and machines. Now a word or two as to the men. Son Saunders went to hospital and I've taken his place in the workshops. One of the flight men went into hospital with some mysterious disease, rumours say spotted fever. Anyway, the remainder of the men who slept in his billet, including Jackson and Davidson, were at once isolated. Within a week, Jackson and Falconer, the carpenter, followed suit and are now struck off. I called Davidson to the window of his hut and told him of your letter. He wishes me to thank you for him and asks if you still have a certain negative which was exposed at Vergallon. We would dearly like a memento of 7888, and I don't think there is much more to tell, sir. I only hope that I have not wearied you with this rambling epistle, and the boys all join me in wishing you the very best of luck. And we will keep our eyes on the honours list, for you cannot hide your light under a bushel forever.
Thank you.
Do you think at this time you were sort of a typical public school boy, hiding your light under bushels and being reticent as to your achievements?
Yes, still, I should think so.
But it's very nice to receive letters like that from people who had actually worked with you throughout those
months. It is nice to get it from the other side, and I value that letter very much.
I'm sure.
Because we were all good friends together, and they were real backers up. Yeah. Sometimes working all night to see that I was on the job in the morning. They were very fine boys.
So they did have this, there was this feeling that you were all working very much as a team, and...
Oh, very much so, but particularly one's own fitter, and of course I was fitter and rigger. They were attached to me individually, most important, and they were very good chaps, very good chaps.
Was it almost like they were lending you the machine, lending you their machine?
They were part of what I was doing. They knew they had to get me into the air. And they never spared themselves on trade union rules or anything. Right.
So when you left with appendicitis, didn't you, a touch of appendicitis, you went on to, after you'd recovered, went on to, I think, CFS at Upavon.
After being released from hospital, which was much longer, which took much longer than it does these days, which is quite comical. I went to a number, several medical examinations, and was not past fit. However, I was sent up to a new venture at Loch Doon in Scotland as with a kind of title of instructor, but we were building a new fighter arrangement. There were the mountains and there were the plains, and on the mountains they planned to run targets on rails and teach people how to shoot at them. It was very interesting. We were a happy crowd up there and working hard with a bunch of about 200 German prisoners of war to help us with the work. As a young overseas pilot, I thought nothing of the idea, but General Branker from the Air Ministry would visit from time to time, and there was the usual difference between the different ranks, and I thought he was full of hot air. Of course, I shouldn't say things like that, but in any case, eventually it was withdrawn. They sent, during the period I was there, two aircraft up there. One was a DH-2, and I was the only fellow up there who could fly a DH-2, so it was my aircraft as far as I was concerned. Eventually, I got into a bit of trouble because I went off with it to a wedding and was reported to the Air Ministry by a colonel who'd taken over the station. Was not an Air Force type, he was an Army type, and he didn't understand the way we used to work and the freedom that we extended to ourselves. So the next thing I found was I was appointed as an instructor at the center at Upavon, the Central Flying School. It was a difficult period for me because I suppose I was up against a kind of court-martial offence, but I imagine the senior staff said, well, about time this fellow was more active. He obviously needs more to do and he should pass his medical tests and get into action. Rather than give me the bother of a court-martial, I think that was probably the right tactics to adopt. So I was at the Central Flying School, which I enjoyed very much and always had enjoyed very much, instructing pupils how to fly a lot of heavy types of aircraft, which I didn't enjoy at all, such as, you tell me, I think the...
Well, the B-2E and the B-12, I think you flew.
B-12, yes, that was a heavy job. So in process of time, there were some of the old 32 squadron chaps there, having come back from France, and I found my way into a very excellent job, being put in charge of the SE-5 training flight. I never found that there was another SE-5 training flight. We had the 56 squadron had in the early part of 1917, a dramatic year in France, but one of the great excitements was when 56 Squadron hit the Arras front. We were being driven from pillar to post by the Germans. They were very much better mounted than we were during this period, and we lost the command of the air that we'd enjoyed during most of the period that I was with 32 Squadron. I didn't take to the SE-5 immediately, but I soon got to like it. It was a heavier one to handle as a fighter than the DH-2, which was very light on the controls. More, the camel was more in that line of country. But we were under great pressure to to turn out pilots. They were under very great pressure in France on the Arras front, and we got to the point of the end of April, when I think our casualties were heavier than they've ever been. Trenchard was very keen to keep up the offensive patrol, but we hadn't got the fighter types to equal the Germans. At the end of April, we started to come out with the SE5s and the Campbells, which remained basically our best fighters during the war. And we had more people mounted on those fighters than anywhere else. So we were at the... I was at the other end commanding this training flight. Every day, the assistant commandant of the Central Flying School would be coming to see me. He wanted to know... He was under pressure, of course, to send people to France. I was a young war pilot, 90 years old, I suppose, but very independent. And nothing in the world would induce me to send a chap overseas until he had passed my standards of flying and possible fighting. And I didn't mind whether I was talking to the assistant commandant or who it was. That's how I felt. And I was backed up by him, really. But I was very, very, very firm about that. The maintenance side, we were short of aircraft, we were short of spares, we were working very hard. I had an excellent flight sergeant. They were very often working all night to try and keep me equipped with aircraft to continue the training on. And that was mighty interesting. And I enjoyed it, and I worked as hard as I possibly could.
You had a two-seat SE-5 as well, didn't you? If
not been. Until 18.
Oh, that's 18, I beg your pardon.
Time went on, and I then was given the opportunity of going to the Gosport School of Aerial Fighting, I think it was called, the Smith Barry School. This was a technical test of people's flying. Many of us were flying imperfectly, slipping on turns and things of that sort. All this was very much corrected and put right. I enjoyed it all, and I'm glad to say I came out with, shall we say, good marks. From there, the year was getting on, and I decided I'd like to go back overseas, so I applied to go overseas. This occurred at the beginning of December 1917, and I was given a flight in 40 Squadron. 40 Squadron has always enjoyed, perhaps a little weakness at the beginning of it, but very good reputation. Kept. Most squadrons had a good spell and perhaps dropped back a bit and perhaps came up again, according to who was flying. But 40 Squadron, its history has been very good throughout the war. Well, I came in during that period of the end of 17. In France, 1917 was one of the most hectic years in the air, well, and on the ground fighting too, of any, particularly so in the air. We were working up on the Arras front. The Canadians had taken the Marvel's attack on Vimy Ridge and taken it, and later on we started the Battle of Arras. This was in close conjunction with the French, who were operating on the Aisne, on the Chemin de Dame, under General Nivelle. Theirs was planned to be a very serious attack. Unfortunately, their troops didn't look at it that way and decided not to fight. So the general front was in a tricky state. We couldn't divulge any of this to the Germans, and so the British had pretty much to take on the pressure, which had not been envisaged. After the Battle of Arras, we moved our concentration effort up to the Ypres front. There we had, in about end of May, there we had a concentrated effort by the Germans against us in the air. And we fought the another serious battle at Messines on the ground, of course, and later on the Ypres battle, which were very serious. The Germans had concentrated their air force and Richthofen and all that crowd up there, and we had made a big concentration, and the fighting was tough and really hard going.
You had actually arrived at a time when 40 Squadron had only really just transferred over to SE5s.
Yes.
So that was an added difficulty, do you think, for the squadron?
We weren't in this battle up there.
No.
I'm just describing the front and what was happening on.
Fine.
This warfare on the front was essentially the front of the Second Army. 40 Squadron were south of that on the First Army, roughly La Bassée Canal area and Lens down to about as far as Arras. At the time that I arrived, they'd had a very active war with the Nieuports, which they had taken over earlier in 17, and done very well. They were just on the point, they'd just changed to the SE5. I came over as a senior instructor at the Central Flying School, and probably do rather more about flying the SE-5 than they did. So in that respect, I had no bothers. But I took it very seriously that a man from home station arriving overseas had to watch his step, because they were looking at you pretty carefully, and they wouldn't stand for any, what am I called, bullshitting. So I was a little unnecessarily quiet about it. The other flights were handled by Mick Manock, who had A flight, and Tud Hope, who had C flight. I had B flight. Mick Manock was the hero of the squadron at that time. He was a short time after that, he left the squadron with 21 victories, and his victories were good. He came onto form, having been older than most of us. I suppose I was only 19 at the time, perhaps 20. a more mature man. He had given great deep thought to the fighting game, and had reoriented his mental attitudes, which is necessary for a top fighter pilot. He had got his confidence, and he had thought out the way that he was going to tackle things.
What was he like in the mess as a?
He became a very good friend of mine, and I owed a lot to him that he was so friendly. Although I was unnecessarily reserved, he liked to give people nicknames, and he called me Noisy, so I was called Noisy in the squadron. But it wasn't a name that stuck. I'd been called Cherub in the 32 squadron because I was much the youngest boy there. But that's what he named me. However, come Christmas, I let my hair down and really had to go around the mess and with the boys and everybody else. So by that time, I had got going. But I'd taken a very keen interest in my flight and all the people involved in it. It's always interested me how a young chap of 19 or 20 took over his flight with the ground staff holding in civil life quite often first-class jobs. Your flight sergeant might well have been a foreman in a large factory or something of that sort. Somewhere, I can't remember what it was, upset me with the flight sergeant. And he had to go. I think I should have said before that when I took over the flight, it was commanded by a South African known popularly, George Lloyd was his name, he was called Zulu. And he took over my job at the Central Flying School, which later on was made into a squadron from a flight. Well, I don't know what it was that upset me about the flight sergeant, whether something awful like I saw him smoking on the tarmac or something, but he had to go. And I wasn't prepared to put his number two in his place, but I took the number three and made him flight sergeant. I was quite clear what I was doing. I'd had quite a lot of experience in the flying corps. I had my flight sergeant at the Central Flying School and so on. But here I was in command of people of that stature. But the flight worked beautifully from then on, and there was nothing that those boys couldn't do to keep us in the air. I mean, it wasn't uncommon to find that they'd never been told to do so, or practically never anyhow, but working all night just to see that the equipment was right for a dawn patrol or something of that sort. They were very, very, very excellent people.
Were you mechanically minded at all?
Not more than a motorcycle type. That I knew about.
Did you actually pay much attention to your machine yourself?
Very much so.
Did you tinker with it yourself?
I didn't tinker with it, no. I expected other people to be able to do their jobs. I might have perhaps tinkered more. What I could do was to swing the propeller. I could teach any mechanic how to swing it. That took a bit of go and some guts. Not the sort of thing that you half-heartedly. You put your whole guts into the swing, and that I could do. But I knew about my engines. The Central Flying School, you went to courses and so on, and knew quite a lot about it. Yes, oh yes.
So when, say, young pilots you trained went out to France, they were much better equipped in a lot of ways than you were when you went out with 32.
Well, no, I don't think that's absolutely true. I learned to do my preliminary flying at the Central Flying School before I went out with 32. And so I had good grounding, and I knew about my motorcycle and how that worked and take it to pieces and so on. No, I was quite some mechanically minded and very keen on the engine working very beautifully. I don't know whether you have got the impression that I wasn't. I was very, very, very keen on the engine, and it worked. And I treated it very kindly. I think a lot of people were... The engines did give trouble, the Spanner Suiza and the other people who made it. And I treated it very kindly, always, rather like being light on the horse's mouth. Mm. I never pushed and pulled or anything like that. It's always done very gently. And I think as a result of that, I got better results out of my engines than most people did. But it was something that I felt very, very keenly about. Well, that was a digression. But the squadron was in excellent order. It had done very well on their Newport. It hadn't developed during that period, the 1917 period, with Newport. It hadn't developed particularly any star turn, but a great many of the pilots involved had done well and shot down Huns. And I remember one of them, his name, he had a DSO and MC and bar. Well, he was rather outstanding. I think he was killed. But after that, Mick Manock broke through. He started badly. Wasn't a very good aerodrome pilot. Took time to get going. And when he'd solved his problems, his thinking and his mental problems, he really started to shoot down two-seaters and other successes. So that, as I said, by a short time in January, he had a total of really good 21 Huns, which was remarkable and outstanding. Now, where do you want me to go?
If we only had photographs to go by, Manock could be viewed on as being somewhat of a dour personality, because I've rarely seen him smiling in a photograph. But he was a lot more fun than that, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, he was a lot of fun. We remained friends right through after he left the squadron. My parents kept an open house in Hampstead, and he would visit there quite often, and he knew the rest of the family. He was very musical. He liked to play violin and liked to sing, and my family was very musical, and I think he found a lot of common ground when he was working up to go out with Grid Caldwell in the 74 Squadron, which was his next important job overseas. But oh no, he had very good humour, quite a lot of fun, absolutely popular in the squadron. But
you said earlier that he was quite a lot older than everybody else.
He was a few years older. He'd been out in the world, been out in Turkey, working with the electrical firms, British firms out there in Turkey, and he was. I think he developed his dislike of the Huns at that time, because he was put in prison out there, and eventually got home, and then got his commission in the engineers. And his his family were a military family, NCO types. They find chaps. Well, his father wasn't so admirable, but they were a very good crowd. And at that point, before he left us, making a close association with hold it.